Chapter 4. Rigid and monarchical in the set of his features lends a certain elevation to the character of his face. He has been known to drive miles in the rain, to see a new kind of rose in somebody's garden, or a monstrous cabbage grown by a cottager. He loves to hear tell of or to be shown something that he calls outlandish. Perhaps it was just that outlandishness of the man which influenced old Swaffer. Perhaps it was only an inexplicable caprice. All I know is that at the end of 3 weeks I caught sight of Smith's lunatic digging in Swaffer's kitchen garden. They had found out he could use a spade. He dug barefooted. His black hair flowed over his shoulders. I suppose it was Swaffer who had given him the striped old cotton shirt, but he wore still the nautical brown cloth trousers in which he had been washed ashore, fitting to the leg almost like tights, was belted with a broad leathern belt studded with little brass discs, and had never yet ventured into the village. The land he looked upon seemed to him kept neatly, like the grounds round the landowner's house. The size of the cart horses struck him with astonishment. The roads resembled garden walks, and the aspect of the people, especially on Sundays, spoke of opulence. He wondered what made them so hard-hearted, and their children so bold. He got his food at the back door, carried it in both hands carefully to his outhouse, and, sitting alone on his pallet, would make the sign of the cross before he began. Beside the same pallet, kneeling in the early darkness of the short days, he recited aloud the Lord's Prayer before he slept. Whenever he saw old Swaffer he would bow with veneration from the waist, and stand erect, while the old man, with his fingers over his upper lip, surveyed him silently. He bowed also to Miss Swaffer, who kept house frugally for her father, a broad-shouldered, big-boned woman of 45, with the pocket of her dress full of keys, and a gray, steady eye. She was church as people said, while her father was one of the trustees of the Baptist chapel, and wore a little steel cross at her waist. She dressed severely in black, in memory of one of the innumerable Bradleys of the neighborhood, to whom as he had been engaged some 25 years ago, a young farmer who broke his neck out hunting on the eve of the wedding day. As he had the unmoved countenance of the deaf, spoke very seldom, and her lips, thin like her father's, astonished one sometimes by a mysteriously ironic curl. These were the people to whom he owed Al Giants, and an overwhelming loneliness seemed to fall from the leaden sky of that winter without sunshine. All the faces were sad. He could talk to no one, and had no hope of ever understanding anybody. It was as if these had been the faces of people from the other world, dead people he used to tell me years afterwards. Upon my word, I wonder he did not go mad. He didn't know where he was. Somewhere very far from his mountain, somewhere over the water. Was this America, he wondered? If it hadn't been for the steel cross at Miss Swaffer's belt, he would not, he confessed, have known whether he was in a Christian country at all. He used to cast stealthy glances at it, and feel comforted. There was nothing here the same as in his country. The earth and the water were different. There were no images of the Redeemer by the roadside. The very grass was different, and the trees. All the trees, but the three old Norway pines on the bit of lawn before Swaffer's house, and these reminded him of his country. He had been detected once, after dusk, with his forehead against the trunk of one of them, sobbing, and talking to himself. They had been like brothers to him at that time, he affirmed. Everything else was strange. Conceive you the kind of an existence overshadowed, oppressed, by the everyday material appearances, as if by the visions of a nightmare. At night, when he could not sleep, he kept on thinking of the girl who gave him the first piece of bread he had eaten in this foreign land. As he had been neither fierce nor angry, nor frightened. Her face he remembered as the only comprehensible face amongst all these faces that were as closed, as mysterious, and as mute as the faces of the dead who are possessed of a knowledge beyond the comprehension of the living. I wonder whether the memory of her compassion prevented him from cutting his throat. But there, I suppose I am an old sad-time Dallas, and forget the instinctive love of life which it takes all the strength of an uncommon despair to overcome. He did the work which was given him with an intelligence which surprised old Swaffer. By and by it was discovered that he could help at the plowing, could milk the cows, feed the bullocks in the cattle yard, and was of some use with the sheep. He began to pick up words too, very fast, and suddenly, one fine morning in spring, he rescued from an untimely death a grandchild of old Swaffer. Swaffer's younger daughter is married to Wilcox, a solicitor and the town clerk of Colebrook. Regularly twice a year they come to stay with the old man for a few days. Their only child, a little girl not 3 years old at the time, ran out of the house alone in her little white pinafore, and, toddling across the grass of a terraced garden, pitched herself over a low wall head first into the horse pond in the yard below. Our man was out with the wagoner and the plow in the field nearest to the house, and as he was leading the team round to begin a fresh furrow, he saw, through the gap of the gate, what for anybody else would have been a mere flutter of something white. But he had straight glancing, quick far-reaching eyes, that only seemed to flinch and lose their amazing power before the immensity of the sea. He was barefooted, and looking as outlandish as the heart of Swaffer could desire. Leaving the horses on the turn, to the inexpressible disgust of the wagoner he bounded off, going over the plowed ground in long leaps, and suddenly appeared before the mother, thrust the child into her arms, and strode away. The pond was not very deep, but still, if he had not had such good eyes, the child would have perished miserably suffocated in the foot or so of sticky mud at the bottom. Old Swaffer walked out slowly into the field, waited till the plow came over to his side, had a good look at him, and without saying a word went back to the house. But from that time they laid out his meals on the kitchen table, and at first, Miss Swaffer, all in black, and with an inscrutable face, would come and stand in the doorway of the living room to see him make a big sign of the cross, before he fell to. I believe that from that day too, Swaffer began to pay him regular wages. I can't follow step by step his development. He cut his hair short, was seen in the village, and along the road going to and fro to his work like any other man. Children ceased to shout after him. He became aware of social differences, but remained for a long time surprised at the bare poverty of the churches among so much wealth. He couldn't understand either why they were kept shut up on weekdays. There was nothing to steal in them. Was it to keep people from praying too often? The rectory took much notice of him about that time, and I believe the young ladies attempted to prepare the ground for his conversion. They could not, however, break him of his habit of crossing himself, but he went so far as to take off the string with a couple of brass medals the size of a sixpence, a tiny metal cross, and a square sort of scapulary which he wore round his neck. He hung them on the wall by the side of his bed, and he was still to be heard every evening reciting the Lord's Prayer, in incomprehensible words and in a slow, fervent tone, as he had heard his old father do at the head of all the kneeling family, big and little, on every evening of his life. And though he wore corduroys at work, and a slop-made pepper and salt suit on Sundays, strangers would turn round to look after him on the road. His foreignness had a peculiar and indelible stamp. At last people became used to see him, but they never became used to him. His rapid, skimming walk, his swarthy complexion, his hat cocked on the left ear, his habit, on warm evenings, of wearing his coat over one shoulder, like a hussar's dolman, his manner of leaping over the stiles, not as a feat of agility, but in the ordinary course of progression, all these peculiarities were, as one may say, so many causes of scorn and offense to the inhabitants of the village. Wouldn't in their dinner hour lie flat on their backs on the grass, to stare at the sky. Neither did they go about the field screaming dismal tunes. Many times have I heard his high-pitched voice from behind the ridge of some slopping sheep walk, a voice light and soaring, like a lark's, but with a melancholy human note, over our fields, that hear only the song of birds. And I should be startled myself. Ah! He was different. Innocent of heart, and full of goodwill, which nobody wanted, this castaway, that, like a man transplanted into another planet, was separated by an immense space from his past, and by an immense ignorance from his future. His quick, fervent utterance positively shocked everybody. An exudable devil, apostrophe they called him. One evening, in the tap room of the Coach and Horses, having drunk some whiskey, he upset them all, by singing a love song of his country. They hooted him down, and he was pained. But Preble, the lame wheelwright, and Vincent, the fat blacksmith, and the other noblest who wanted to drink their evening beer in peace. On another occasion he tried to show them how to dance. The dust rose in clouds from the sanded floor. He leaped straight up amongst the deal tables, struck his heels together, squatted on one heel in front of old Preble, shooting out the other leg, uttered wild and exulting cries, jumped up to whirl on one foot, snapping his fingers above his head, and a strange carter who was having a drink in there began to swear, and cleared out with his half pint in his hand into the bar. But when suddenly he sprang upon a table, and continued to dance among the glasses, the landlord interfered. He didn't want any acrobat tricks in the tap room. Apostrophe, apostrophe, they laid their hands on him. Having had a glass or two, Mr. Swaffer's foreigner tried to expostulate. Was ejected forcibly. Got a black eye. I believe he felt the hostility of his human surroundings. But he was tough, tough in spirit too, as well as in body. Only the memory of the sea frightened him, with that vague terror that is left by a bad dream. His home was far away, and he did not want now to go to America. I had often explained to him that there is no place on earth where true gold can be found lying ready and to be got for the trouble of the picking up. How then, he asked, could he ever return home with empty hands, when there had been sold a cow, two ponies, and a bit of land, to pay for his going? His eyes would fill with tears, and, averting them from the immense shimmer of the sea, he would throw himself face down on the grass. But sometimes, cocking his hat with a little conquering air, he would defy my wisdom. He had found his bit of true gold. That was Amy Foster's heart, which was a golden heart, and soft to people's misery, apostrophe he would say in the accents of overwhelming convictian. He was called Yanko. He had explained that this meant Little John, but as he would also repeat very often, that he was a mountaineer, some word sounding in the dialect of his country like Ural, he got it for his surname. And this is the only trace of him that the succeeding ages may find in the marriage register of the parish. There it stands, Yanko Gurl, in the rector's handwriting. The crooked cross made by the castaway, a cross whose tracing no doubt seemed to him the most solemn part of the whole ceremony, is all that remains now to perpetuate the memory of his name. His courtship had lasted some time ever since he got his precarious footing in the community. It began by his buying for Amy Foster a green satin ribbon in Darnford. This was what you did in his country. You bought a ribbon at a Jew's stall on a fair day. I don't suppose the girl knew what to do with it, but he seemed to think that his honorable intentions could not be mistaken. It was only when he declared his purpose to get married that I fully understood how, for 100 futile and inappreciable reasons, how shall I say odious, he was to all the countryside. Every old woman in the village was up in arms. Smith, coming upon him near the farm, promised to break his head for him if he found him about again. But he twisted his little black mustache with such a bellicose air and rolled such big, black fierce eyes at Smith, that this promise came to nothing. Smith, however, told the girl that she must be mad to take up with a man who was surely wrong in his head. All the same, when she heard him in the gloaming whistle from beyond the orchard a couple of bars of a weird and mournful tune, she would drop whatever else he had in her hand. She would leave Mrs. Smith in the middle of a sentence and she would run out to his call. Mrs. Smith called her a shameless hussy. She answered nothing. She said nothing at all to anybody, and went on her way, as if S.E. had been deaf. She and I alone all in the land, I fancy, could see his very real beauty. He was very good-looking, and most graceful in his bearing, with that something wild, as of a woodland creature in his aspect. Her mother moaned over her dismally, whenever the girl came to see her on her day out. The father was surly, but pretended not to know, and Mrs. Finn once told her plainly that this man, my dear, will do. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.